Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240 for Autumn Semester 2021. Today, free cash flow analysis. The subject of this week is our last topic that's in the textbook. Next week are two special topics, ethics and Federal Reserve. Those are entirely lecture, and so you will want to make sure that you take really good notes on those, although there are PowerPoints that will be provided for additional online resources for you on those. Now, the topic this week is free cash flow analysis. And I have a PowerPoint presentation. You see, this topic at the end of this course is actually the basis of what I teach to the international delegations for ministries of finance from West Africa and the Caribbean and Central America. They come here for me to teach them this subject. And so I have a PowerPoint that I use as part of that presentation to them. And so that I will put up for you to have to use as well. Now, this is sort of a modification of one that was done by Cengage some years ago, but it's got a lot of extra stuff in it and some changes in wording and terminology. So I ask that you do not share it. It is a proprietary PowerPoint from Cengage and from me, but it will help you with this subject. It's not a hard subject. It's just, it can get detailed, but once you get the hang of it, it's not tough at all to do. That's on the agenda for this week. Now, a quick look at the numbers here. As you can see, it was just, it was a positive day, but it's a whoop-de-doo kind of thing. Oddly, the Dow was up almost 0.3%. The S&P was up a whopping 0.09%, and then the NASDAQ sort of trailed the pack at 0.07%. The fact that they were all positive is good news, however, simply because they were all positive. So the market isn't in a sour mood. It was just that there wasn't anything to get really excited and happy about, as there have been in days recent. Now, coming over here, crude is fighting its way back up. The dynamic is working like this. The U.S. and Europe are putting whatever political pressure they can on Saudi Arabia, especially, and other Arab oil exporting countries, to keep production up, to keep the prices down. This is obviously because we don't need high gas prices going, making the potential for a recession even worse than it is. Now, Saudi Arabia has always accommodated us, as have other oil exporting countries in that part of the world, simply because they want to maintain good relationships with the United States, and also, as basically, Saudi Arabia buys, we sell them enormous amounts of weaponry for their military, and so they want to keep us happy, and we'll keep them happy. It's an unfortunate dynamic, considering that they are not particularly the most desirable people in the world, that political regime in Saudi Arabia, considering its murderous prince and a few other issues with their human rights problems. But one way or the other, we're trying to get them to keep their oil production up, and they're saying, okay, we will try. However, there are forces that are trying to push that price up. And so we will make it to $90 a barrel, possibly by the end of this semester. You'll be seeing that. Gold and silver. Gold had a neckline at about $1,800 an ounce. And it has found the north side of that neckline, which is an issue for us because we certainly understand that metal prices going up can be a signal of inflation. Okay, so yeah, we're seeing these metal prices going up. So that's some evidence that there is some inflationary pressures coming around the edges. The bond yields went up 4.5 basis points on the 10-year benchmark. 4.5 basis points is a serious amount. Well, not a serious amount, but it's enough to take notice. So the yields went up. That means prices went down, which means that money was going out of bonds, and some of it was definitely going over here into equities, not much. Kind of troubles me that you see this money may have been flowing here as a harbor, an inflation harbor. Bonds suffer during inflations. You see, because the face value of a bond is fixed at $1,000. So as inflation starts to punch in, the purchasing power of that face value is being eroded. So inflations scare investors away from bonds. They move to other things. So that's a concern. So in other words, the inflationary pressures would make investors sell away from bonds, which would push the yields up. The yields going up is evidence of the embedded expected inflationary premium, inflation premium, in the risk-free rate. So it's all interlocked in there, and I'll bring that up again. That probably didn't go over too well with you. But we've got now the Financial Times. It just bobbled around. It was aimless today. Nikkei was in kind of a grouchy mood all day. It went down into negative territory in early trading, and it just never got anywhere from there. And it just kind of ground around at about 0.33% down for the whole day. So here we are. Going into the, there was something else I was going to show you here. I'm going to keep this open. Well, I didn't mean to do that, but I'll get back to it here in a minute. Now, one last topic from last week that I want to come through and finish up was break-even analysis. This is one of those finance tools that has been around for ages. I mean, this is an old one. It was kind of around back in the 1800s. And it's still relevant to this day. I do it. And I'm going to show you a somewhat simplified version of a break-even analysis I did with my own company. Typically, the note card I had in my office, I left there, but I think I can remember the numbers. But it works like this. Look, profit, that dirty word, is total revenues minus total cost. Now, the total revenue would be the price per unit times the number of units. And the total cost we could divide up into variable cost and fixed cost. The variable cost is the cost that moves with your production. Production goes up, the cost goes up. Production goes down, the cost goes down. Now it's, well, I won't get into that. Fixed cost is just there. Whether or not you sell a single unit, you pay this cost. In my business, I will go to an art show, a festival or an exhibition. I'm going to pay a fee to go there. There will be an application fee and there will be a booth fee. Those are going to be paid, and it doesn't matter whether I sell anything. I have to pay the fee to play the game. So, for example, at a typical show like Schaumburg, I pay $50 in suburban Chicago, $50 application, $250 for the platform. At the one-of-a-kind market in Chicago that's coming up, that application is $25, and then the staggering fee, I've got a little discount, is $2,750, which is, I pay that whether I sell anything or not. And I'm going to be in the pier with 600 giant egos crowding each other around trying to sell stuff. So this fixed cost is going to sit there. It's just there. A factory is just there. The boss is just there. Now, this unit, the variable cost, we can do variable cost per unit times the number of units, your wholesale cost, something like that. And then you've got your fixed cost here. Now, I can factor out the Q. So I've got profit is P minus the price per unit minus the variable cost per unit times the number of units minus the fixed cost. Nothing big about that. However, the surprising thing maybe is that this is realistic, pretty darn realistic, and it is a linear equation. If you notice, this is nothing but a y equals mx plus b. That's all it is. Straight up linear equation. So in other words, profit is the dependent variable, output, sales is the Q, and the negative fixed cost is the y-intercept. And the slope of the thing is the P minus V. It's just straight linear. It's just a straight up linear equation. Now you notice that you are in negative profit territory until you climb out of that fixed cost. That's your grind. It's getting up out of there. Now, different companies in different industries have different representations here. You will have some companies that have fairly low fixed cost, but it takes a lot of output to get that out there to break even. Then you have other kinds of companies that have rather deep fixed costs, but they have very sharp rises. An old term, old school, it's not a correct term, but it's just been there forever. See this price minus variable cost per unit, price per unit minus variable cost per unit? This thing is, you'll hear it called unit margin. Unit margin. That's technically a margin is a ratio, but I mean, it's just the way it's always been. So in other words, if I buy something wholesale for $20 and I sell it retail for $50, my unit margin is $30. And again, margin is supposed to be like a ratio term, but it's just been this way for forever. Now, a point about this is that a lot of it has to do with the industry. Manufacturing industries tend to have just massive fixed costs. Those factory in the pipes and the wires and the trucks and everything. I mean, it's just insane, the large scale of the fixed costs. Like an oil company, a big oil company, my gosh, the fixed cost is in the staggering hundreds of billions of dollars. But then you have some where the fixed cost is relatively low, but the margin can't be very wide, price minus variable cost. So you have to make a lot of the product to have it work. Examples of this, candies, little candies, the big families, the Kraft family and all those, Bazooka, Bubblegum, those companies for a candy would cost in the early days a penny. It would cost maybe a half a penny to make it. So you would have to sell hundreds of millions of them to make a fortune, and they did. It was not, I'm going to be a millionaire next week. No, that's not how it worked. They just ground it out year after year after year, making sure that kids could get their hands on the candy, that they were addicted to it. You kept down you suppressed the bad PR about tooth decay and obesity and diabetes and all that. You just kept the product going. The massive volume of sales was what worked. Another example of this are stores like Dollar Tree and Dollar General. Their unit margin is miserable, but they just have so many stores that it's a hugely successful business model. Aldi's works on the same principle. I may not like Aldi's. I hate having to pay a deposit for a cart. Do I look like I need a cart to steal? No. Well, maybe I do. Okay. But it's a brilliant model. Just a little bit on each sale, and then if you sell millions of them, you can crawl out of negative profit territory and get break even. It's clean, it's easy. So the whole thing here is that we want to know Q star is break even output. So in other words, we're saying at what point do you get a profit of zero for P minus V quantity times Q minus FC? You rearrange the terms, and what you get is the Q star. The Q star will be the fixed cost over the unit margin, P minus V. Nothing hard about it. It's very simple, and it actually works. Notice, the obvious is, of course, the larger your fixed cost, the higher your break-even quantity has to be. In other words, you're crawling out of a big hole if your fixed cost is high. Another thing is that distance between the price per unit and the variable cost per unit is important in this as well. That margin, if you don't have much distance between price and variable cost per unit, price per unit and variable cost per unit, you got a long haul ahead of you. And the idea that I can choose my price, well, you can think you choose your price. You can even choose your price in the short run. But you are going to find out that the price is governed by forces way beyond your control. The competitive environment, the price elasticity of demand of your consumers, the income elasticity of demand of your consumers, the regulatory environment in which you're operating, which can increase and force you to increase your price, the sales tax, the local sales tax has to be taken into it as a factor in the price that you're charging. I can't charge as much in some districts simply because the tax is so stupidly high there that I'd price myself out of the market. So I don't even bother those venues anymore. I won't mention any names of any cities, but one might be something like Chicago. Anyway, okay. How does this work out in practice? I'll show you. If you want to come to my office, I have some of my artwork in my office. You can see the actual physical examples of this. I will use one of my artwork categories, the 30-inch by 20-inch full-framed big dogs, the big ones. The typical price for this, depending, and it does vary depending upon what city I'm doing this in, but it would be about $600, okay? And you're saying, okay, well, you son of a bitch, that's an awful lot. Do you think you're that good? Yeah, I am that good. I'm better than that, in fact. Okay, so now, as far as the variable cost, this is an average, and I worked this out over a number of pieces. That would be the frame, that would be the acid-free backing of the print, a 400-year archival print of the artwork, the mat, usually a double mat, and then the dust paper on the back, and then the wires and all that kind of stuff, museum glass, comes to an average of $232 for the variable cost, which means that my unit margin per work is 600 less 232, which would bring us down to $368 is my unit margin. That's my slope of my profit line. Kind of weird to say that sometimes is to actually say a mathematical thing, slope of a profit line, and see an actual amount of money that actually happens. Okay, so now, the fixed costs at a typical show that would be in a place where people would buy my stuff, the first thing I would do is I'd probably have about a $25 application fee. I would have a $250 booth exhibition fee, and then amortizing a part of my fixed cost of my frames, the setup stuff. I don't include that because that's sunk. I've already bought it. Okay. You know, the wire racks and the tent, pop-up tent and the covers. That's not a cost because I've already spent it. It's gone. It's with Jesus now, or Muhammad, or Buddha, whatever. However, to drive there, set up, sleep in my car, and then shower in the Travel America, shower in the mornings, is going to run me about $150. Oh. How about food? Do I include food or not on the road? The answer is no. You're going to eat whether you're on the road or at home, okay? So we're going to come down here, 5, 7, 2, 3, 5. Let me make sure that's right. That doesn't look right. 7, it's 12. Yeah. Okay. Did I forget anything in this? Yeah, I did, and it's hard to put it in there, the wear and tear on my vehicle from these travels, the tires and all that kind of stuff. But let's just hold it here. So break-even Q is going to be $425 divided by $368. So what's my break-even output? What is it? Oh, it's 1.15? No, it isn't. It most certainly isn't. It's 2. You don't have a part of a product. So I have to sell 2 at any given art show in order to break even. Okay, that's wonderful. Let's do the next thing. Let's say that I sell 4 at a show. Now, So in other words, 600 times 4, I pull in revenue of $2,400, $368 variable cost. Oh, wait, no, I did that wrong, 232. I was going to say that's way too high. 230, I apologize for that, 232 times 4, 8 to 9, $928. Okay, minus the 900, plus my 425 is 3513. So 1353 in variable and fixed cost. So I've got 1047 dollars profit. Wow, I can go to a good restaurant. Yes, siree. No, I can't. That's crap. Because, you see, that money down there? I've wiped out four from my inventory. I have to replace those. How much is it going to cost to replace those? $232 each. So 4 times $232 each is a little over $900. Wow, that sure did take that down. Now we're talking Denny's Grand Slam on the sale weekend. Okay? You see, what happens is that the brutality of business is that you hear about these people who make their fortunes and they're wow kinds of awesome human beings. Well, you're not going to be one of them. Neither am I. Unless you are the one in a million. And probably, in order to be that successful, you're going to have to be a sociopath, cluster B person, narcissistic personality disorder, something like that. The normal business is grind it out, day after day, show after show, turn the page and get back on the road to do the next gig. That's how it works. And if you want to be an entrepreneur, it has its advantages. You're your own person, but the disadvantage is that you are hanging out with a lot of gypsies, tramps, and thieves. I once had a show where they put me next to a guy who did art with a chainsaw and a log. He would carve animals with it, which was awful. And then there he was out there, and he carved, he took the giant log and he carved a beaver. And I thought, you know, there's something really circle of life about this. Beaver eats wood, wood becomes beaver. Anyway, the hell with it. Clearing that out. Now, let me take you to the main event today, free cash flow. Free cash flow. Now, in this, you're going to hear me use the term operating rather frequently because, and I've said this before, and now I'm hitting home with it, at the end where it actually matters, chapter 12 in the textbook and all that, culmination of FIL 240, is the word operating. Operating matters to us. You see, there are a couple of things. Yes, the long run is wonderful, and we have to keep our eye on it. But the reality is that you have to meet payroll. You have to meet your light electric bill. You have to pay your debtors. You have to pay Uncle Sugar, the taxes. The operation is what matters. How we finance it, that is what comes once we see how much free cash flow we have at the end. In other words, the project has to be analyzed, unlevered. In other words, without taking into account debt or equity or whatever it is that you use to finance it. Once you've got down there to the bottom line, you see a number. Let's say it's $50 million. Then you can say, okay, that $50 million, we could borrow money and pay interest at some coupon, and this $50 million would pay the interest. We can sell, we can use our existing retained earnings, we could, and pay dividends to our shareholders. We could get in new shareholders. But it's that money there at the end of the free cash flow analysis that says what we can do to get this project to happen. If we try to mix in the financing along the way, that's the wrong approach. The project should be able to stand on its own. Okay, now, one caution that is, debt is obvious, what its cost is. God, I got to write an interest expense check this month. Equity is sneaky. Equity, it looks like, oh, we just pull it out of what we made in profit last year. Or we just sell some stock, lol. Well, free money. Reality is that as you saw before, equity is more expensive than debt. It's just sneaky. You don't see it right away. Well, who cares if our stock price goes down? Well, that actually increases your cost of equity. So the next time you go out there to try to sell stock, you're going to sell it at a discount because no one wants your company's stock anymore. So it's going to cost you a lot of money to get someone to sell the stock for you, and you're going to have to sell it at a low price anyway. So, okay. Now, I'm going to say a few things along the way here, but the term operating just keeps coming up. First, we have the word incremental. The extra. Projects should be looked at in isolation, sandboxed from the rest of the corporation. You can't just assume, well, this will help our other sales. Prove it. Get me numbers and show me. And if you are wrong, I will have your ass fired for it. You better prove that this product actually does something good. More than likely, revenues, you've got to watch out for two things. Saying, okay, there's positive externalities on our other products. Show me how this product helps our other products. Sometimes they do. If you've got a product that has a very good green footprint, in other words, as an environmentally good product, that can get more sales for your other products because the people get a positive view of your company. However, measuring that is highly dubious. You can have focus groups and all that. Focus groups really are a lot less reliable than you want them to be. Would you buy this product at this price? How about at this price? You find out people don't work that way. In the focus groups, just the data just doesn't get supported. But the reality is, though, that don't let positive externalities. Here's another one. Well, this is going to help Mother Earth, the environment. We're saving the planet. Who cares? I hate to say it that way, and God knows we are in a mess as far as the climate goes. But at the same time, for you to say that your product, you're going to add some revenue to your product because you're helping Mother Gaia, yeah, that's the same Mother Gaia that tossed your house around all over Kansas in the last tornado. Don't let those fuzzy, well, we put in an extra couple $1,000 every day because we're doing such great work for the world. Don't do that. Be cold. If it does do good, yes, absolutely. But don't let it be part of your financial analysis, or you'll be taken down the road to ruin. Cannibalism. I better mention that. Be careful that your product doesn't cannibalize other products you've got in your inventory, brand registry. That's a disaster. It can happen. And actually, in some cases, you mean it to happen. Oftentimes, you have a product that has been very popular for years, but you know that that cash cow has to be replaced as time goes on. You don't want to just jerk it off the shelves and throw something else on the shelves, but you need to diminish it and say, okay, we're going to bring in a new product. Now, maybe consumers would buy our old product, but with this new one, they're not going to. They're going to buy this product that we're just bringing out. So cannibalism can happen, and you can deliberately do it. An example, Gosh, there's so many examples of it. Shampoos. In the 1950s and 60s, and even into the 70s, there were some very popular shampoos. As a matter of fact, when television first came along, there were a lot of products that had a new way to get people absolutely hooked on them. One shampoo was called Prel Concentrate. It was a shampoo. They had an ad. They would drop a pearl into the Prel shampoo, and it would drop down slowly while this baritone voice narrator said, "Prel is thick, rich, and luxurious." And then they dropped the pearl into the leading brand, and it dropped to the bottom real fast. Okay, Prel was huge for years. You can still see it on the shelves. But that company has moved on, and it's offering much more modern products now that eventually will completely wipe out Prel, and it will be finally ended. At least I suppose it will. There are other shampoos that did the same thing. Like there was one called Gee, Your Hair Smells Terrific. I've still seen that around, I think, in recent years. But these products, you do actually have the cannibalization effect going on. You mean it to, you predict it. So in other words, your revenue, incremental revenues, must take into account not just price times quantity of the new product, but price times quantity minus lost revenues from a product that it is cannibalizing. You don't want that to happen unless you mean it to happen. That's why I talked recently in these lectures about car companies trying to absolutely do everything they can to separate brands so that they don't cannibalize each other. This is true of cars. It's true of hotels. It's even true of banks. The same bank that lends money at great rates to upper middle class and rich people is the one that's screwing over the poor people with those payday loan and two-week paycheck places, on the other hand. So now, projects. There are two kinds, new and replacement. And just like the names say, a new project is something that is brand new. It hasn't been done before. Or it is a notable improvement of an existing product. A replacement project is one where you are going to bring in something that will replace an existing something, most likely for cost savings. So you have a fleet of trucks. $15,000 a month. We can get a new fleet that's $10,000 a month. So they're both costs, but the new project you would analyze as an increment of $5,000 in cost savings, $15,000 minus $10,000. So it's not always revenue. Sometimes it's a reduction in cost. Now, these can happen for a number of reasons. Like I said, efficiencies, cost savings. It could be just a matter of environmental regulatory requirement. We have to do this, and what happens if we don't do this? Well, we're going to get our butts fined back to the Stone Age if we don't do this. We're also opening ourselves up to future liability. In some cases, you don't have to replace a product, some machine or something that you've got. You don't have to. But you know that if you keep using what you got, you're eventually going to get into liability that will knock your socks off. And so you make the change before you end up paying out the butt for something that's going to happen because of the old machine. A gruesome place down in Georgia was where there was a smelting operation, melting ore to get the metal out of it. And you go into this one part, it was basically a death wind tunnel. There was this fan that's about as tall as this room and wide, and it would spin and it would draw cool air to blow down into where the metal had come off and there was air needed to cool it. Well, the worker who accidentally stepped into the wrong place near that room where that fan was would get sucked right into it, chopped up and thrown down into the molten cooling metal. Well, this company had that operation running for over 100 years. And it was not because of regulation. The regulations came later, the OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. It was because they had, by the time you get into the 1950s, 1960s, the courts were willing to say, okay, you killed that man, you are going to pay his family $50 million. That was why they finally replaced the machine. The new system, cooling system, was more expensive on its face, but it did save them hundreds of millions of dollars every year in wrongful death lawsuit settlements. So sometimes it's not how much you are making, it's how much you are saving. And sometimes it's not just directly, well, this is a cost savings, energy efficient. No, you're just avoiding future liabilities by replacing a product. Now, that having been said, we go on here. And we lay out. You'll have your revenues. Now, you can do this a couple of ways. Cost of goods sold, and that brings you your gross income or gross profit, however you want to say it. Gross income. Now, minus your selling, general, and administrative expenses, SG&As. Operating. So, wages and salaries, light bills, internet bills, shipping, advertising, operating. What is associated with the function of the company to get the product made and sold? And then the depreciation expense, which actually doesn't exist, but we are required by accounting standards to put it in there. And what will happen is this non-existent item will protect some of this revenue from taxes. It creates a tax shield. Now, we're going to have to take care of that and fix it later because that's not what really happened. Some of you have come to my office, you hang around my office, and I welcome you there, and you've seen my story I love to tell the story, my $4,500 photographic lens. I am not allowed to say minus $4,500 on my taxes. I have to chop that up and depreciate it over the years. But what really happened was $4,500, and some of you have seen that lens. You can see why it's that expensive. Okay, fine. We get down here. This is operating income. Once we subtract out SG&A and depreciation expenses, it's operating income. Again, operating. Now, the next thing the accountants would do is say minus interest expense. And we say, no, not interest expense. It is not operating. That's what we figure out once we know whether we got positive free cash flow or not. This is unleveraged. We need to find out what money this project is going to generate to see if we can get financing, equity or debt or whatever, to pay for it. The next thing we're going to do is we're going to subtract the taxes. And we usually do that as the corporate tax rate times operating income. Now, a quick word about this. Historically, we had a 39% marginal tax bracket for a long, long time, more than several decades. Historically, that was quite low. originally 90, 70%, and then in the 1920s, the three conservative presidencies and their congresses drove it down to 28%. And then finally, we got the crash and the disaster that their policies had led to. We got a much more aggressively progressive administration in Congress, and so we started going back up. We were at 70% for some time, and finally it got down to the 39%. Stayed there, very stable. Then in 2017, the tax rate was cut to 21%, the top tax rate. And most corporations don't pay that anyway. But the reality was that it was cut way down. I mean, that's a hell of a drop, nearly 50% cut in corporate taxes. Now, there was a lot of hope that it would be returned to 39%, but that has been pretty much dashed now because the pro-low tax crowd is framing it that this would be, taking it from 21% to 39% would be a massive tax increase. It probably is going to stay around 21%, which is why we'll have deficits that you folks will have to take care of, however you want to do it. Okay, so the book and most textbooks use 39% or 40%. It's 40% for simplicity. Know that that is not what's going on right now. And you're going to see an interesting side effect of that on Wednesday. It's actually a surprising side effect of an extremely low corporate tax rate. But a lot of books, and even the PowerPoints sometimes, you'll see, they'll call this incremental earnings. That's a bad term for it, and it's being replaced more and more by the term NOPAT, net operating profit after taxes, NOPAT. As a matter of fact, I didn't even really notice it until recently, over the past 5 years, when I've had conversations with corporate finance executives. They'll just drop NOPAT. They say it's now become part of our lexicon. The net operating profit after taxes, NOPAT. And so we come to where we are no longer in the territory of the accountants. We take the net operating profit after taxes and we add back the depreciation expense because that never actually happened. We have it in there because it does protect some of the revenue up here from taxes. But now we recognize that we never wrote a check to depreciation. I always thought, I wonder what would happen if I actually made a corporation called depreciation. So everyone had to write a check to depreciation expense every year. Oh well, it's just an idea, okay. So now, what really did happen, we had actual capital expenditures. We actually spent money. In my case, that's $4,500, which still galls me to this day. We actually spent money. And then we have the change in net operating working capital, NOWC. Now, net operating working capital is current assets minus current liabilities. So the change in net operating working capital would be NOWC for the current period minus NOWC for the previous period. So in other words, At this time of the year, I begin to build inventory for next year. Now, I'm not allowed to put that anywhere on my income statement for tax or for accounting. I can't put it there. It is like invisible. For this year, I'll be doing about of various sizes. I'll be doing, oh God, it's probably going to be eight. About $200 each, because some are more expensive than others. So that's going to be $1,600. That's not anywhere over there. That is all in inventory. That's all in inventory. Now, I'm also going to be doing some Christmas sales where people can pay part now, part later. So if someone buys a $600 work from me and they put $200 down, $400 to be paid over the next 12 months, the end of this year, I'm going to report that they paid $600, when in fact $400 of that was accounts receivable. So in other words, when that current assets goes up relative to current liabilities, that is a sinkhole for money, for the free cash flow. On the other hand, if I did, like I really can, I found some way that I didn't have to pay all my bills as often as I do, then I could have my current liabilities. That would be a pump for money back in. Like that's going to happen, though. Do you follow what's going on here with this? Okay, great. So, now, here's the thing. When I was doing this like 10 years ago, the typical company wouldn't have this. So what's going to happen here? Let me say it. Where the delta NOWC, the change in net operating working capital, it would have not been like it is now. Let me show you. I'm going to pull up one here. We'll go to SEC.gov. And I'm going to go to the EDGAR filing system, filings. Company filing search. Now, let's do Netflix and chill. That was a joke. Lol. Okay, the hell with it. I'm trying, okay? Give me a break. It's late. Okay, here. I'm going to drop this down. Interactive data. So now I'm going to bring down the Excel spreadsheet. And I'm going to say yes. This will be the Netflix, I hope. Yep. Okay, so now. Get this off and get another one on here. Okay, here we go. Consolidated operations. Okay. Now we're going to go over here. Now, one thing to bring up. Back in the day, depreciation expense would have been required to show on the SEC filing. It isn't. As a matter of fact, they don't even require that you put in the gross income line, which drives me crazy. So do know that oftentimes when you pull up these SEC financials, you have to do some tweaking and add some lines, or depreciation usually ends up being over here in the statement of free cash flows. Statement of Amber, okay. Geez, Zoe, look at this. They got a pair of them here. Amortization and depreciation. You'd have to put both of those together. That's a hell of a lot there. God, that's billions. Okay, anyway. Okay, let me take it over here. Here's what I want to do. I'm going to get the net operating working capital for 2 years. We'll do the 2020 and the 2019 and take it down here. NOWC, And then over here, we'll do the change. So coming up here. Oops, I didn't want to do that. So we're going to take equals for 2020. Current assets minus current liabilities. Let me do that again. Yep, that's right. And for 2019, current assets minus current liabilities. My God, look at that. You see this? Whoops. They went from negative $677 million in net operating working capital in 2019, clear up to almost $2 billion in net operating working capital in 2020. So they actually, the change was, 2020s minus 2019s. Hello Kitty. $2.6 billion sinkhole. Now, you see that? That's money disappearing into content and things like that. That's money vanishing, going away. Holy cow, that's a lot of money. That's negative free cash flow. See, minus the change, minus $2.6 billion. Where in the hell did that money come from? Well, I'm not going to do the whole thing this time. I'll do it on Wednesday, but here, look. Okay. They borrowed about $1 billion. So that was part of how they put into the freezer that much money. Also, they brought in about $500 million selling new stock. And then, oh, there it is. Oh, a $3 billion increase in net profit. They used a lot of their internally generated equity. In other words, their bottom line. That's where they got all this money to finance this giant increase in operating working capital. Yeah, so I mean, this is kind of like first year forensics. Where did this how did this dead body show up here? And you trace it back through the different avenues. So here, Netflix increased the amount of net operating working capital by $2.6 billion. Okay, where did the money come from that they did that with? Well, I see that they increased their amount of debt by $1 billion, so obviously they used some debt to do it. But also the rest of it looks pretty obvious to me that they sold some new stock, and they also obviously had to pull some out of their retained earnings. In other words, their profit. That's how they did it. Now, take it over here and say, okay, let's look at Netflix. They don't pay a dividend. So in other words, they don't have to sweat. The free cash flow that they've got, whatever we're going to find next time for free cash flow, the one thing is that obviously they have to have money down there to pay their interest expense. And obviously they want to have money down there so they can plow it back in to do things like increase their net operating working capital. But one thing they're not worrying about is paying a dividend to their shareholders. Okay? So that would smell to me like some risk. But if you look at the beta is pussycat risk, 0.81, below 1. Here's where it is. The risk is showing up in price-to-earnings ratio. That's high. So in other words, Netflix is actually a relatively risky company. It's certainly using free cash flow for some other than for providing dividends to shareholders. And it's plowing back into operations, increasing the amount of debt that it has, selling extra stock. Okay. Yeah, it's kind of a risky company. And with a market cap of nearly a third of $1 trillion, well, the next question, and this is where we get into the financial and analysis, all that kind of stuff. The question is, okay, Netflix has grown primarily through its life through increases in subscription. What happens at the point where there are no more new markets for Netflix to get new subscriptions in? It bragged about how it had penetrated India. Obviously, 1 billion new subscriptions there. Well, one, there are other services that subcontinent has that many prefer to Netflix. And two, what happens if you get all 1 billion of those people to subscribe? Where do we go next for subscriptions? To Antarctica? The penguins don't want to see any stupid Netflix. To Siberia? They're busy trying to keep from freezing to death there. The point is that there's somewhere along the line, Netflix will run out of running room for growth through subscription and increased subscription rate. And the only way it will be able to keep going is by what it's been doing all along. Jacking up its prices without even bothering to ask permission of its consumers. Sooner or later, someone will come in and say, we've got something better than Netflix. Whether it's Hulu, Apple TV, whatever, the prospect of Netflix keeping going with how it's playing it out now is not a good way to get a financial analyst like me to be impressed. When we get down to the bottom line, we will see what the free cash flow situation is, and then we will be able to get an intrinsic value for Netflix stock, and then we'll see from there. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Netflix is worth more per share than its current price of $650 a share, but maybe not. Stay tuned. I'll talk to you on Wednesday. Thank you for being here.